Welcome to Words to Live By, a podcast series hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. Each week, we will share some of the wit and wisdom of Ronald Reagan. In essence, Words to Live By, made up of radio addresses and speeches he delivered from the 1960s through the 1980s. In November 2022, State Department officials went to great lengths to prevent a meeting at the G20 summit between Biden and Putin because they knew that at some point the two leaders would cross paths. But U.S. officials ruled out a formal meeting and took steps to ensure that the American president does not encounter his Russian counterpart in hallways or even in a group photo. Why? Well, the answer is that President Biden thinks Putin is a killer, a war criminal, and he doesn't want to meet with a killer or a war criminal. Both of Biden's immediate predecessors, Barack Obama and Donald Trump, crafted foreign policies that involved direct engagement with traditionally adversarial leaders. Obama, as a matter of bridging difficult diplomatic divides, and Trump, in creating personal and political alliances. Biden has had less engagement abroad. And today, Vladimir Zelensky of Ukraine is Time's Man of the Year and awarded such an honor for standing up to the Soviet Union. So, with that in mind, just how did Ronald Reagan handle those pesky Russians?
As the foundation of my foreign policy, I decided we had to send a powerful message to the Russians that we weren't going to stand by anymore while they armed and financed terrorists and subverted democratic governments. I wanted peace through strength, not peace through a piece of paper. In my speeches and press conferences, I deliberately set out to say some frank things about the Russians, to let them know there were some new fellows in Washington who had a realistic view of what they were up to and weren't going to let them get away with it. At my first press conference, I was asked whether we could trust the Soviet Union, and I said the answer to that question could be found in the writings of Soviet leaders. It had always been their philosophy that it was moral to lie or cheat for the purposes of advancing communism. I said they had told us, without meaning to, that they couldn't be trusted. I wanted to let them know that in attempting to continue their policy of expansionism, that they were prolonging the nuclear arms race and keeping the world on the precipice of disaster. I also wanted to send the signal that we weren't going to be deceived by words into thinking they'd change their stripes. We wanted deeds, not words. And I intended to let them know that we were going to spend whatever it took to stay ahead of them in the arms race. We would never accept second place.
That was an excerpt from his autobiography, An American Life. He takes his time to explain his position clearly. So, what was his reasoning?
During my watch as president, there was nothing I wanted to do more than lessen the risk of nuclear war. Our relationship with the Soviets was based on détente, a French word the Russians had interpreted as freedom to pursue whatever policies of subversion, aggression, and expansionism they wanted anywhere in the world. Every Soviet leader since Lenin had said the goal of the Soviet Union was to spread communism throughout the world. Except for a brief time out during World War II, the Russians had been our de facto enemies for almost 65 years. All this while, their policies had been devoted to the single purpose of destroying democracy and imposing communism. During the post-war years, America repeatedly stood up to the threat of Soviet expansionism, going to the far corners of the world to defend freedom. Turkey, Greece, Korea, Southeast Asia, and elsewhere. It was our policy that this great democracy of ours had a special obligation to help bring freedom to other peoples. Sometimes the price of defending freedom was very high. Many brave Americans made the ultimate sacrifice. Yet America had always been willing to pay the price of defending human liberty. During the late 70s, I felt our country had begun to abdicate its historical role as the spiritual leader of the free world and its foremost defender of democracy. Some of our resolve was gone, along with a part of our commitment to uphold the values we cherished. While the Soviets had built new warships, missiles, bombers, and other weapons, we had done nothing to modernize our strategic forces. Just as it had accepted the notion that America was past its prime economically and said our people would have to settle for a future with less, the previous administration had accepted the notion that America was no longer the world power it once had been. Consciously or unconsciously, we had sent a message to the world that Washington was no longer sure of itself, its ideals, or its commitments to our allies, and that it seemed to accept as inevitable the advance of Soviet expansionism, especially in the poor and undeveloped countries of the world. Predictably, the Soviets interpreted our hesitation and reluctance to act and our reduced sense of national self-confidence as a weakness and tried to exploit it to the fullest, moving ahead with their agenda to achieve a communist-dominated world. With the breathtaking events that have occurred in Eastern Europe since then, it is easy to forget what the world was like in the spring of 1981. The Soviets were more dedicated than ever to achieving Lenin's goal of a one-world communist state. Under the so-called Brezhnev Doctrine, they claimed the right to support wars of national liberation anywhere in the world and to suppress through armed intervention any challenge to communist governments anywhere in the world. In El Salvador, Angola, Ethiopia, Cambodia, and elsewhere, the Soviets and their surrogates, Cuba, Nicaragua, Libya, and Syria, were seeking to destroy non-communist governments through campaigns of subversion and terrorism. In Afghanistan, they were brutally trying to suppress a revolt against communist rule with tanks and rockets. In Poland, they were responding to the tentative stirrings of a democratic movement with ominous hints of an invasion, the same method they had used to crush brave freedom fighters who sought to bring democracy to Hungary and Czechoslovakia.
Okay, he's laid out how relentless, brutal, and determined the Russians behaved. It was Truman who once said the only things the Soviets understand is strength. By the 1970s, the issue of nuclear warfare was hovering over every global discussion. And we have to remember that Ronald Reagan was a devout man who believed in the Ten Commandments and the power of prayer. Where did he stand on this issue?
But in addition to sending out the word that the United States was dealing with the Soviet Union from a new basis of realism, I wanted to let them know we realized the nuclear standoff was dangerous for all of us, and we had no designs on their territories. They had nothing to fear from us if they behaved themselves, and we wanted to reduce the tensions that had led us to the threshold of Armageddon. Nothing was more important to mankind than assuring its survival and the survival of our planet. Yet, for 40 years, nuclear weapons had kept the world under a shadow of terror. My dream became a world free of nuclear weapons. I realized no one could win a nuclear war, and one must never be fought. And I came into office with a decided prejudice against our tacit agreement with the Soviet Union regarding nuclear missiles. I'm talking about the MAD policy, Mutual Assured Destruction, the idea of deterrence providing safety so long as each of us had the power to destroy the other with nuclear missiles if either of us launched a first strike. Somehow, this didn't seem to me as something that would send you to bed feeling safe. It was like having two Westerners standing in a saloon aiming their guns at each other's head permanently. There had to be a better way.
More about President Reagan's method of dealing with the Russians right after this brief message.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation is the nonprofit organization created by President Reagan himself and specifically charged by him with continuing his legacy and sharing his principles: individual liberty, economic opportunity, global democracy, and national pride. We must remain vigilant and work together to share these conservative principles with younger generations. Your role is critical to move our mission forward. Thank you for your continued support. Please visit reaganfoundation.org/give. That's reaganfoundation.org/give.
Now, let's go back to understanding how President Ronald Reagan handled the Russians. At this point, he's got an ace up his sleeve. Let's listen.
A certain amount of mythology has grown up around the Strategic Defense Initiative, the program I announced in 1983 to develop a defensive shield against nuclear missiles. It wasn't conceived by scientists, although they came on board and contributed greatly to its success. Early in my first term, I called a meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, our military leaders, and said to them, "Every offensive weapon ever invented by man has resulted in the creation of a defense against it. Isn't it possible in this age of technology that we could invent a defensive weapon that could intercept nuclear weapons and destroy them as they emerged from their silos?" They looked at each other and then asked if they could huddle for a few moments. Very shortly, they came out of their huddle and said, "Yes, it's an idea worth exploring." Well, my answer was, "Let's do it." So the SDI was born, and very shortly named by some in Congress and the press, Star Wars. As the myths grew, one of them was that I had proposed the idea as a bargaining chip to use in getting the Soviets to reduce their weaponry. I've had to tell the Soviet leaders 100 times that SDI was not a bargaining chip. Some people may take a different view, but if I had to choose the single most important reason on the United States side for the historic breakthroughs that were to occur during the next 5 years in the quest for peace and a better relationship with the Soviet Union, I would say it was the Strategic Defense Initiative, along with the overall modernization of our military forces. I wanted to go to the negotiating table and end the madness of the MAD, MAD policy. But to do that, I knew America first had to upgrade its military capabilities so that we would be able to negotiate with the Soviets from a position of strength, not weakness. It was ridiculous for both nations to continue this costly, open-ended competition to build bigger and better offensive weapons able to annihilate the world. I felt that if I could get in a room alone with a top Soviet leader, the two of us might be able to reduce the risk of nuclear war. Shortly after I was discharged from the hospital after I was shot in the spring of 1981, I sent a handwritten letter to Leonid Brezhnev, the top Soviet leader, declaring my interest in opening a dialogue between us that would lead to peace. It was what I called quiet diplomacy. I didn't get anywhere with Brezhnev, and before long he died. Then I wrote similar letters to the two men who followed him in the Kremlin, Yuri Andropov and Konstantin Chernenko. But before I could get anywhere, they died too. One night I asked Nancy, "How am I supposed to get any place with the Russians if they keep dying on me?"
But in March 1985, things changed. Daylight came into the Oval Office.
In March 1985, Chernenko was succeeded by a new man in the Kremlin, Mikhail Gorbachev. And that fall, in Geneva, after exchanging several letters with him, I got the chance I'd been hoping for to get a Soviet leader alone in a room. On the eve of our flight to Geneva, I made an address to the nation in which I said we were at a special moment in history with a unique opportunity to set the course of peace through the 21st century. And I really felt that way. It was my hope and purpose that at Geneva, Mikhail Gorbachev and I would begin a process that our successors and the peoples of our countries would continue after we were gone. The American goal at Geneva, I said, was not only to avoid war, but to strengthen peace, not only to prevent confrontation, but to begin the process of removing the sources of tension that produced confrontation, not to paper over our differences, but to acknowledge and address them realistically, to encourage talk not only between our leaders and diplomats, but between the people of our countries. In going to Geneva in hopes it would lead to a true arms reduction agreement, I was also planning to live by an old Russian adage, "Dovrai, no provriai," trust, but verify.
It was November 1985, Geneva. Cold, snow, and great expectations. The President and Mrs. Reagan were lodged in an 18th century residence on the long gray expanse of Lake Geneva. In the distance, they could see the Alps. In his diary the night before, President Reagan wrote, "Lord, I hope I'm ready and not overtrained." Neither the President nor Mrs. Reagan slept well in the days leading up to the summit, trying to adjust to the time change and in an attempt to be fully prepared for the work ahead. But Secretary of State George Shultz assured the President, that if the only thing to come out of this first meeting with Gorbachev was an agreement to meet again, then the first meeting was a success. But President Reagan's goal was much more than that. He believed that if he was going to break down the barriers of mistrust that divided the two countries, he had to begin by establishing a human, personal relationship between the leaders of the two most powerful nations on Earth.
During the previous 5 years, I had come to realize there were people in the Kremlin who had a genuine fear of the United States. I wanted to convince Gorbachev that we wanted peace, and they had nothing to fear from us. So I'd gone to Geneva with a plan. The Russians were bringing their team of diplomats and arms control experts, and we were bringing ours. But I wanted a chance to see Gorbachev alone. Since Gorbachev had taken office 8 months earlier, he and I had quietly exchanged a series of letters that had suggested to me he might be a different sort of Russian than the Soviet leaders we had known before. That morning, as we shook hands and I looked into his smile, I sensed I had been right and felt a surge of optimism that my plan might work. As we began our first meeting in the presence of our advisors, Gorbachev and I sat opposite one another. I had told my team what I was going to do. As our technical experts began to speak, I said to him, "While our people here are discussing the need for arms control, why don't you and I step outside and get some fresh air?" Well, Gorbachev was out of his chair before I could finish the sentence. We walked together about 100 yards down a hill to a boathouse along the lakeshore I had arranged for in advance. As we descended the hill, the air was crisp and very cold. I'd asked members of the White House staff to light a fire in the boathouse before we got there, and they had. Only later did I discover they'd built such a rip-roaring fire that it set an ornate wooden mantelpiece above the fireplace ablaze and had to be doused with pitchers of water a few minutes before we arrived. We sat down beside the blazing hearth, just the two of us and our interpreters. And I told Gorbachev that I thought he and I were in a unique situation at a unique time. Here you and I are, two men in a room, probably the only two men in the world who could bring about World War III. But by the same token, we may be the only two men in the world who could perhaps bring about peace in the world. "Mr. General Secretary," I said, "we don't mistrust each other because we're armed. We're armed because we mistrust each other. It's fine that the two of us and our people are talking about arms reductions, but isn't it also important that you and I should be talking about how we could reduce the mistrust between us?" As Gorbachev and I talked beside the fire, it was clear he believed completely in the Soviet way of life and accepted a lot of the propaganda he'd heard about America, that munitions makers ruled our country, black people were treated like slaves, half our population slept in the streets. Yet I also sensed he was willing to listen, and that possibly he sensed, as I did, that on both sides of the Iron Curtain, there were myths and misconceptions that had contributed to misunderstanding and our potentially fatal mistrust of each other. I knew that he also had strong motives for wanting to end the arms race. The Soviet economy was in shambles, in part because of enormous expenditures on arms. He had to know that the quality of American military technology, after reasserting itself beginning in 1981, was now overwhelmingly superior to his. He had to know we could outspend the Soviets on weapons as long as we wanted to. "We have a choice," I told him. "We can agree to reduce arms, or we can continue the arms race, which I think you know you can't win. We won't stand by and let you maintain weapon superiority over us. But together, we can try to do something about ending the arms race." Our meeting went on for an hour and a half, and when it was over, I couldn't help but think something fundamental had changed in the relationship between our countries. Now I knew we had to keep it going. As Robert Frost said, there would be many miles to go before we sleep. As we walked up the hill toward the house where our advisors were still meeting, I told Gorbachev, "You know, you've never seen the United States before, never been there. I think you'd enjoy a visit to our country. Why don't we agree we'll have a second summit next year and hold it in the United States? And I hereby invite you." I accept, Gorbachev replied. Then, with hardly a pause, he said, but you've never seen the Soviet Union. I said, no. And he said, well, then, let's hold a third summit in the Soviet Union, and you come to Moscow. I accept, I said. Our people couldn't believe it when I told them what had happened. Everything was settled for two more summits. They hadn't dreamed it was possible.
Thank you for listening. For more information on the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, including information on how to become a member, information on upcoming exhibits at the Reagan Library, and more information on the legacy of President Reagan, please visit ReaganFoundation.org. And don't forget to like and follow the Reagan Foundation on all social media platforms.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Words to Live By podcast in your iTunes or Google Play stores and on other podcast platforms as they become available. New episodes of Words to Live By come out every Tuesday. Like what you hear? Check out our A Reagan Forum podcast featuring great speeches delivered at the Reagan Library. New episodes drop every Thursday. And don't forget to follow at Ronald Reagan on Facebook, at Ronald Reagan 40 on Twitter, and Reagan Foundation on YouTube. Also, search for us on SoundCloud and Stitcher.